This episode is brought to you by Leatherneck Magazine. Scuttlebutt listeners, attend! Huh! It's time for Leatherneck Magazine's annual writing contest, and we want to know what you think makes a good leader. The history of the Corps is filled with legendary examples of outstanding leaders, and today's Marines maintain that tradition of excellence. Drawing from our storied history, or from your own experience, describe the single most important thing you've learned about leading Marines, or describe an outstanding Marine Corps leader and what makes them successful. Submit your story by March 31st, and you can win up to $1,000 in prize money. Your story may also be featured in a future issue of Leatherneck. Visit www.mca-marines.org for more details or to submit your entry form. Contest is open to all authors. Good luck, and Semper Fi, Mac. We would like to thank Leatherneck Magazine for sponsoring this episode. Hey, Scuttlebutt listeners, thank you so much for joining us again. I'm Vic, and I'm here. We are starting a new segment. We're calling it Catching Up with Old Friends. And as our inaugural series commander now coming through is Aaron Sullivan. Aaron, man, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me back. It's good to see you.
And so Aaron came on. Oh, geez, that had to have been coming up on 2 years now.
I think that sounds right.
Yeah. When I was out in Cali, seeing all your West Coasters, being super jealous. And we linked up via LinkedIn, no pun intended, but I guess it's there. And then it turned out there that we had so many inroads. Just for those folks who maybe missed that episode, if you could just give us sort of a brief sort of backstory or as detailed as you want, just who you are, where you came from, and you know, how we got linked up.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so I was a assault amphibian officer, and from 2000... That's right, 2007 through late 14, early 15. And when I got out of the Marines, I started a company, was there a couple of years, ended up joining a nonprofit group called Bible Project, and was there for 5 years. And while I was there, encountered some challenges around international currency management, which was my inspiration to start the current company that I founded and lead called Pangea. So yeah, other than my time in the Marines, I've pretty much been in startups, both for-profit and nonprofit. Married, two kids. I still live here in San Diego, California, courtesy of Camp Pendleton. And yeah,
that's so cool. So yeah, we happened to be at Third Tracks at the same time, just at different. Well, I guess not the same time. I left the summer of 13, and you were coming on because Jason Filos took over my company, and then you were one of his platoon commanders. So,
yep,
that's we sort right. of crossed paths there. And then I was working CD&I here at Quantico, and you were at AVTB.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yep.
Which I can't believe we didn't run into each other all the times we were talking ACV and having stuff come down and doing all the testing and stuff, but. Yeah. So thank you, LinkedIn. And now, man, it's been great sort of following you, everything you're doing and, you know, talking to folks through Bible Project who knew you and I know now. And yeah, it's been a really great thing. So along those lines, so let's talk about Pangea. So could you give us, I guess, the 35,000 view of what Pangea is, and then we'll start to dial in a little more on, you know, what it is that you guys actually do.
Yeah, for sure. Well, so, and I probably explained it similarly on the last show, but whenever you've traveled internationally, you are probably pretty accustomed to having to exchange, you know, currency. So if I travel to London, I've got to change out my dollars for pounds. Now, most of us use credit cards, but when you swipe your credit card, that's essentially what the bank is doing on your behalf for a fee. They're exchanging your US dollar denominated credit card, you know, funds for Great British pounds. Now, when we're traveling, having fun, we don't really think much about that. But businesses that operate internationally have to do this all the time. And in fact, nowadays, if you start a company, you're pretty much global right away. You know, it used to be that like you got to a certain size and you're like, okay, well, we dominated, you know, regionally and then statewide and then nationwide. And now we have the scale and the capability to go international. But today, everyone's basically international by default. I mean, you can be like, you know, a small craft maker in Omaha, Nebraska. You're buying, you know, raw goods online from Indonesia, receiving those goods, you know, creating a, you know, a product of some sort, selling it on Shopify, you know, a global e-commerce platform based out of Toronto, and your customers are in Europe and the UK and Australia. And, you know, it's basically an international economy at this point. It's moving more that way. And so the challenge is that today, digitally driven companies or tech companies, and even all the way down to small and medium-sized businesses, if everyone's doing business internationally, there's a lot of challenges that traditionally came with that. And one of those is managing currency. But typically companies like Apple, they have a 500-person treasury team. So not their finance department, just their treasury team. And that treasury team is responsible for managing, you know, currency contracts and things like that. You know, most tech companies are moving at a speed and scale and complexity that humans can't even wrap their mind around really what's happening, you know, in the code and the transactions. And small and medium-sized businesses alike don't have a treasury team. It's like, you know, one person or a very small team. So we built a technology platform that uses AI that basically replicates what a human treasury team would do, but it can do it really fast, it can do it at scale, and it can do it in a purely automated way that essentially makes the currency, you know, relationships between countries disappear so that you can just do your work. You can just run your business.
That's really cool. And so when the way you explained it last time was when you were with Bible Project, you were talking 7-8 figure things as you are working with artists and content developers, and you are working in language translations of biblical texts, of podcasts, of all of these things that required people on the ground in those countries to translate in that native language, and where for like, you know, Vic Rubel, you're talking 8 figures seems astronomical. But what you were saying is before Pangea, if you weren't talking 9 to 10 figures, most folks weren't really wanting to deal with the currency exchange rates and the hedging. Is that correct?
Yeah, I would say that if you're doing even under $100 million a year, the bank basically treats you like an individual. Like, you know, you're basically you're of no consequence. You know, when you get to 500 million or more per year, you actually get a relationship with somebody at the bank that will kind of give you preferred rates, preferred treatment. But it's not really till you're in the multi-billion dollars of international volume where you can even afford to build the team internally that would manage it. And so really to go from a place of sort of not managing currency to like professionally managing currency, you've basically got to be a mid-cap public company with a dozen person treasury team, billions of dollars of FX flow, or you have no chance of competing in the international markets with any level of professionalism or optimization, which just basically means it costs you a lot of money and puts you at a lot of risk. And so, you know, effectively what we're doing is reducing the barriers of entry and the speed in which you can implement complex, sophisticated solutions that just make you more competitive as a business. And you can do it, you know, at the size of a couple million a year in volume.
Without having to assume a ton of risk that right. As you're in the process of negotiating something that by the time you come to an agreement, the price has already changed and now you owe more money. Right.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. As an example, we help a lot of nonprofits. We've got a number of nonprofits that have programs in Kenya. And over the last 21 days, the Kenyan shilling has devalued, or excuse me, has revalued against the dollar 14%. So last month when you did your budget for your Kenya operations, this month you're going to need 14% more money to do the same thing that you would have when you budgeted last month. This happens across the world all the time. And, you know, with some of the solutions we offer, we can help mitigate or eliminate that potentiality.
Yeah. And so I guess the question is that as an Amtraker who worked at a ton of startups sort of on your own that had really nothing to do with finance, where I you know, when we had talked, you know, working, like we had mentioned, working with Bible Project, you saw that there was a risk that you could, there was an opening, or there was a market for something like Pangea. What is it in you that said, let me fill that gap with Pangea? Like, where does that come from?
Yeah. It's a good question. I mean, I think it's interesting when you're in, the stat I'm sure doesn't hold true right now because we're not in many kinetic environments as a military, but I know when you and I were in, we were in during the height of the Iraq war. And at the time, Marines love to boast this stat that we were responsible, I think, for 5 or 6% of the DoD budget, but we're responsible for 34% of combat operations worldwide. I mean, you know, Congress must just love Marines efficiency.
Right.
And I think that one of the reasons Marines are so good at that is that we're scrappy. We know how to solve problems, creatively solve problems. You know, mission accomplishment is of the utmost priority, and we have the resources we have. What are the problems we need to solve? And really, when you think about startups, that's really not any different. You know, if you're in an organization and that organization has a problem, they lean on their people to identify those problems and to create creative solutions to those problems. That's all a business really is, except the business is sort of humanity or the market you're in. And you're finding a problem that exists outside of any one company. And you're basically saying, hey, I've got a solution to that problem. And you build a company to solve that problem. Now, it's a little bit more complicated because you've got to figure out funding. You've got to get resources. You've got to figure out how to sell that product. But effectively, that's all startups are, is they're just identifying a gap in the market and creating a solution to a problem. I mean, you know, and I think oftentimes when you think about competition, quote unquote, you know, if you're in a business and you're like, hey, and you're in accounting, and you're like, hey, the warehouse has X, Y, Z issue. They're kind of like, well, we kind of have people we pay to solve that problem. Go back to accounting. And I think in the global marketplace, when you create these solutions, well, in some ways, you're both vying for the same job in that business to solve that same problem. So it's a little different, but fundamentally, yeah, man, it's startups and entrepreneurship. It's just about solving problems.
So interesting, because I would say that the current cult, well, you know, there's the way I see it, a world according to Vic, there's sort of an interesting dichotomy of perception, you know, and I guess we'll start with perception because that's where a lot of the impetus in this drive comes from. If you perceive the world in a certain way, then you will either be hopeful of your initiative or you will be so beaten about the head and ears that you just, all you want to do is just, you know, swim with the school. Right. When you look at sort of the way I see it again, like there is this sort of almost irrational feeling that I can become an influencer. Right. I hate to speak begrudgingly about the emerging generation, but there is this sense that because of the internet and the availability of influencers and all of these various social media platforms, that if all I can do is like master this one dance or pull off this one trick or have a hot take on YouTube, I can then essentially, I can brand myself. My startup initiative is myself as my brand. Then there's the other side of it that's like, look, it's an oversaturated market everywhere. What you need to do is go into an established place. And I feel like what you have done through Bible Project, through Tradiv, through now Pangea, is that you're in that middle ground where it's a very calculated, well-informed move, but you're not going to just fall and you're not just going to become another cog in the machine. There's a question here, I promise. That is the same. Where the hell does that come from? Like, is that really being like the OPSO at AVTB and having this, you know, understanding of the environment, having the training of, you know, SMEAC and OODA loops and all of these, you know, JJ did type buckles that you got to see that, like, AVTB, you know, again, is this sort of weird hybrid that exists between acquisitions and the DoD. It's a DoD entity, but it also exists outside of, you know, sort of the normal MAGTAF structures. Being an OPSO then on that lonely island, you know, lonely island on a lonely island, is that where a lot of this comes from?
That's an interesting question. So I would say that actually how Marines are trained in thinking about, you know, concept of the operations, about mission sets around, you know, both purpose, method, and state, actually does correlate really well to the corporate environment. I think the difference is like, if you're the OPSO at a battalion, you're very much playing like the operational role that connects strategy to tactics. You're down at the platoon commander company level. You're very much on the ground tactics. Mm-hmm. I think in a corporate environment, as you're tackling problems or business strategy, you're operating at like everything from the joint chiefs of staff all the way down to the tactical level. But actually, depending on who you're talking to in your organization, you need to be talking at a tactical, operational, or strategic level. Mm-hmm. Because really, you know, whatever your organization's mission is, you're going to have a long-term strategy on how to get there. Well, you've got to break that strategy down into phases and stages. And, you know, within a stage, you've got some very pragmatic tactical goals you need to accomplish, but they better tie to a you know, 1 or 2 year operational strategy. And hopefully that operational strategy ties to your overall overarching business strategy. And absolutely, like, understanding the environment is pivotal. Understanding how the strategic, operational, and tactical approach ties to one another is imperative. So, you know, actually, I think that, you know, Marine Corps officers would make great strategy officers for corporates. I don't know if they actually know what they're missing, because the way that we think about the operation is, I have yet to see matched in any of the best corporate minds that, you know, didn't come from a military background.
Yeah, that's interesting. I heard it. I guess it's a metaphor. It's more of a story. But it was basically, there's a wise man and a young man, and the young man asks the wise man, you know, how do I, you know, essentially, he's about to leave the home. Like, how do I navigate this world? And so he tells him to put two drops of oil into a spoon and then to walk into this room and try not to spill the oil in the spoon. And so the young man walks in and he walks around and then he doesn't spill anything and says, "Hey, I did it." And the wise man says, "Well, what did you see in the room?" He said, "Nothing. It was focused on the spoon." And he goes, "All right, go back in there and I want you to tell me what it is that you see and then come back." And then he comes back and he tells him everything he sees, but he spilled all the oil in the spoon. And the wise man says, "The secret to making it in life is to be able to appreciate all the stuff that's around you, but always stay focused on not spilling what's in the spoon." Mm-hmm. Anyways, that being said, I think what you're alluding to and what the military kind of just, you know, beats into you is that you have to do both, especially as a combat arms officer. You, like you said, you've got your all 10 fingers, all 10 toes in the tactical. You can't lose sight of the operational, and you damn sure better not lose sight of the strategic, or you're going to get people killed or fired.
Right. Yep.
So yeah, I think that's really profound, that, you know, that statement that military officers would make great strategic officers in corporate America. But at the same time, you aren't corporate America fully.
Well, that's true. Yeah, startups are more flat organizations, mm-hmm. at least at first. I don't think anybody really has a good definition of when a startup is like no longer a startup. but yeah, it is more flat. It's very fast paced. It's easy to change business plans or pricing or things like that because there's less repercussions. Certainly, there's elements of corporate America that you would, you know, probably envision in your mind as being true for startups as well. You know, objective and key result tracking, performance reviews, lots of meetings, you know, all of that's still very much true. Yeah.
Does that sort of flat that flat structure,
yeah.
is that more appealing to you? Like, do you like that sort of team atmosphere vice something is perceived as so, you know, more stodgy, rigid structure pyramid of what most folks would assume is how corporate America functions?
I wouldn't say I do. I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with good hierarchical structures. You need them as you scale to be efficient. But that introduces opportunities, I think, for things to go sideways. You know, in a more flat organization, you have a handful of good leaders, the organization runs well. As soon as you have, you know, a more, this isn't a word, but like divisionized or departmentalized structure, communication can break down, which is then the onus is on both good procedures and good leaders to make sure it doesn't. But also, I think if you're on, you know, at a low, if you're kind of an individual contributor with a bad manager, it doesn't really matter how great the organization is, you're going to have a really poor experience as an employee. And so that's, I think, why corporate America in with more hierarchical structures get such a bad rap, because it's not really the hierarchical structure. It is either the culture of the organization or their hiring and development of leaders that lead to really, you know, shitty experiences for the people working there.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, I guess that's a great dovetail then into or segue into sort of what I want, why I find what you're doing so interesting, and why I felt like catching up with you was so important for our listeners, is that, you know, no secret that talent management is fully underway now, talent management 2030, and the Marine Corps just fucking knocked it out the park. Our recruiting numbers are through the roof, and our retention numbers are through the roof earlier than when anyone had even, you know, as you remember, like FTAP numbers was always coming down to the last minute where you're just like blowing bonuses and, you know, school seats or whatever to get those last few folks across the finish line. And I think in 2023, I think they exceeded 100% of FTAP results by July.
Wow. That's incredible. Why do you think, like, in the world according to Vic, what did they do that's helped them be so successful? I'm curious.
Yeah, I really wish I was as plugged in to be able to speak as intelligently about it. But from my understanding, it was this idea of to take out some of the rigidity of that reenlistment stuff, like in the change. Change in the mindset. You know, I know Sergeant Major Black was big on this, talking, and obviously General Berger as well, but our model was, you know, recruit, train, replace. And they wanted to go into the recruit, train, retain. And that it's not just butts in seats. It's that we have this corporate, you know, as we're talking about having an older force, a more mature force. You can't just give guys the boot after 4 years and take all that money and time that we've invested and just say, hey, good luck, man. You know, we've got guys on the yellow footprints now that are going to come back for you here in you know, the next 9 to 18 months. And so I think we really started looking at, like, is it such a bad thing to homestead? Is that really so awful? Do families always have to live in shitty barracks? Does the food always have to suck? If you have a guy who wants to go to school but doesn't want to get promoted, just wants to delay his promotion just for a year so he can finish grad school, does he all of a sudden get a P? Is he already now being looked at as, you know, some sort of like Judas in this, you know, in the culture, right, because he's not willing to constantly jump on the grenade? I think a lot of that had to do with it. And I think, you know, I think they're still working on how to get tech savvy folks in to be able to fully compete with industry when you're talking about leaders who have experience in the private sector who want to serve, but they don't want to come back. And, you know, they have a 3 master's degrees and, you know, all these various certificates, but yet you're going to make them a second lieutenant. I don't know. You know, it's not quite as attractive. They're taking like $100,000 pay cut.
Yeah, totally.
So I think they're looking at lateral entry things. It's still prickly. But one of the things I think they're starting to talk about, and I think they're really doing, is they put a lot of onus on training and education. It's like, rather than having to always pluck from outside, why don't we grow from inside and really train our guys up well, and then reward them for having, you know, we're having served with Space Force or having these, you know, drone knowledge stuff or anyways, I think we just are trying to get a lot smarter on what it means. You know, because, you know, for us, so much of it was like, well, I'm a Marine. Like, this is what Marines do. Like, I wanted to be a Marine. It's awesome being a Marine. I take a lot of pride in being a Marine, and that pride in belonging, that's just what's going to carry me through. You know, thank you, sir. May I have another? I don't think the emerging generation really buys it as much anymore. You know,
right.
But I guess I'll put the question on you. Like, how does that work for you? I mean, you're on your third of startup now. What do you look at from talent management, and do veterans factor into that?
Oh, for sure. I mean, yeah, I think, and we may have talked about this last time, but, you know, so we actually use, I mean, I would say a very lightweight, redacted version of R2P2 in our annual planning process. So we're a remote company. So everybody is working, you know, from their home office or from a co-working space around the world. And so it's really important that when we get together, we can do centralized planning, because we're essentially doing decentralized operations, you know, throughout the year. And so we use, we use an R2P2 planning process that, and it's funny, you know, we, at first I was reluctant, because anyone that's transitioned from the military to the private sector, you're like, you're kind of careful to import too much of, you know, your approach to things in the military into that environment. But actually, you know, we've done the annual planning process at least 3 times, and semi-annual, you know, 2 times. So this last one, I just kind of fully sold out and was like, all right, we're going to use certain terms that are very clear. And so, you know, we've got a mission for the season, we've got objectives, and each objective has a main effort and a supporting effort or 2 supporting efforts. And it's amazing the amount of clarity that it brings to people in those situations when they're like, oh, I'm the main effort. It's actually my responsibility to accomplish this objective. It's your responsibility to help me in X way. Just super efficient, super helpful. And so anytime we have veterans that are interested in joining the company, what I know is that I am getting millions of dollars worth of training on how to think, on how to plan, that I'm not going to have to pay for and that I can take for granted. And so, yeah, I mean, veterans are definitely, we have, I mean, our company is only 20, 20 full time, maybe 30 with part time. And we've got an Army Ranger captain, a Marine Corps major, and a Marine Corps captain, you know, all serving. And guess what? They become central facilitators of that planning process because they know the process.
Yeah.
And, you know, people have increasingly trust the process. But to answer your broader question, how do we retain? I think, you know, that is, so I would say that there is, and what I hope the Marine Corps doesn't fall into is there are these, what I would call like vanity retention methods. So like, hey, we have a ping pong table in the office. We've got coffee and cold brew and beer, and we serve you lunch.
Cereal bar. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like this is like a total, like I call it the Googlefication of the workplace. Those might be nice things, but I don't actually think they move the needle much in retention, because they don't actually get to what people really desire from work. And so if you're familiar with like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, despite how people might feel about like the whole self-realization thing, ultimately what it is it's just, it's a way to think about what people need. And it starts at a basic level. Like I need to have food and shelter. I need to have like a family environment that allows me to feel safe. I want to be able to do something where I feel both accomplished personally and affirmed relationally. And ultimately, if you kind of have these different stepping stones that we as humans naturally desire, it ends with really finding purpose. Is there purpose in your life? I think when, you know, there are certain types of companies that might be able to overcome this, but I think generally speaking, like, you know, if you're working at a place that, you know, I don't know, makes t-shirts, unless you're really passionate about t-shirt design, more than likely you're going to experience that as a job. And I think it's actually going to be hard to retain people long-term in jobs like that, because it's not really profession, it's job. And so I think, you know, retention always starts with hiring correctly, hiring right. It's hiring people that are both value and purpose aligned. You know, are you passionate about solving macroeconomic challenges? Not at all. Okay, well, I may not want to hire you because there's not much alignment as far as to what you are looking for in your profession. Now, we have quantitative researchers that were, you know, PhDs in particle physics, went and worked at, you know, the particle accelerator in Switzerland, then went into finance, and they're really good at working with very complex, random systems. And they love solving hard quantitative financial problems. They're a great fit for what we do because their professional desires align with the purpose of the organization. So I'll maybe let you respond before I go deeper into retention, but I think ultimately good retention starts with a good hiring, and it's finding people that are values and purpose driven aligned with whatever the goal, mission, or objective of your company is.
Yeah, no, that totally makes a lot of sense because, yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, no matter what the euphoria was upon entering the workplace, that honeymoon period is going to be over. And then you're going to realize like, oh, this is a fucking job.
Yeah, totally.
And so, yeah, in that, I think that is where leadership has to read the tea leaves and know that, you know, this, it's not always going to be, you know, this euphoric place all the time. So how do we, and that's, I guess that's like, do you try to find the grit in the hiring process, or are you trying to cultivate and encourage grit in the workplace? Like, is it a chicken and egg thing, or are there milestones that you're or I guess, you know, firing lines that you're shooting on?
Yeah, no, there's, so I would say that, you know, so I don't remember what the, in the fit rep, I don't remember the different categories in which we sort of rate, you know, our Marines, but our version of that is we look at competency, character, and chemistry. Mm-hmm. Competency is very much going to be, you know, similar to sort of your competency in your MOS or your job type combined with sort of your accomplishments. You know, how hard do you work? How hard do you drive? And so
that's a data driven metric, right?
100%. I mean, that's really like, that's base level. Of course, when we hire somebody, hey, we need to know that you're competent, technically proficient to actually do the job, you know, of course. But in any one job, maybe with the exception of a few very technical fields, there's no shortage of people that can technically do the job. And so, you know, we can figure that out on a resume. Typically, I can look at a resume and go, this person has the technical skills that we need. So really the more important one then is character. If somebody comes into an interview, you know, you can discern pretty quick, like, are they there for the money? Are they there just for themselves? Are they prideful and lack humility? Well, don't hire that person based on character, because they're not really there. Actually, even to their own detriment, I think they're not there because they have found purpose. They're there because they're fighting for more base level needs in their life and are willing to take advantage of situations in order to get, you know, what they believe they need. And so I think hiring off of character is really incredibly important once you kind of pass the litmus test of, is this person technically capable of doing the job? I think growing people's character, growing people's grit, absolutely companies can do that. That's a long-term objective though. Like you're not going to accomplish that in a training cycle of 2 or 3 months. So the third one's chemistry. And I think that's really where it's on the company to do that. That's really creating an environment where employees trust leaders. They feel empowered by their leaders. They're affirmed by their leaders. They're challenged by their leaders. They feel, you know, they're able to be vulnerable. They trust that they're going to take care of them. And you also create a place where relationships and friendships can thrive. I think there's been like three independent, well, there's been a ton of studies, but there's three really big ones about like what makes an employee happy in the workplace. And one of the most important factors is they have a friend at work. You know, I think that comes down to chemistry.
Yeah.
And so that's really, I think, when it comes to retention, you know, first the company needs to hire well, both based on competency and character, and then they need to create a team where the chemistry allows team members to perform above a level in which any one particular person's intelligence or capabilities would necessarily suggest they would. You know, you take subpar soccer players, put them on a team, build great team chemistry, and all of a sudden they're beating giants. And it's not because any one of them is the best player, but because them as a team are great players. That comes down to chemistry.
No, that makes a ton of sense. And obviously, you know, we've seen that, you know, as being part of a vehicle crew, being commanders of platoons. It's like, I'm not concerned about what Washington has to say about this war. I'm fighting this because I'm not going to leave my brothers hanging out. You know, guys are jumping on extending, you know, are you guys going to deploy again? Of course I'm going to extend. And if I don't, I'm going to be super pissed. And I'll get to go out with my guys again. Yeah. No, that makes a ton of sense. That's good. And that is your guys' approach. I think that works. But I guess if we could step back just for a minute then on, you know, clearly there's a lot that goes into just building a startup. It's much more than just having a good idea or even having good people. Where trying to think of how to properly phrase this to tease out what I'm trying to get at is where does that entrepreneurial spirit, does it come from? Like, obviously it's within yourself, but like, let's put it this way, for those who are listening who feel like, hey, I've got this really great idea and I want to make this happen and I want to be a part of this startup community, where does, you know, where do you walk the walk and talk the talk? Like, at what point or what advice would you have for someone who's sitting there saying, I've got this great idea, I just don't know how to make it happen?
Sure.
What is it? What was it in you that you always felt confident that I'm going to step off of this established thing. Like, I already did a startup, it's working. Now I'm going to walk away and start this other thing, and I'm just as confident that this is going to work out.
Well, this is a long answer, so feel free to cut me off at any time. Young entrepreneurs. Yeah, I mentor some young entrepreneurs, and we have this, you know, this kind of conversation not infrequently. So first, I would say that being an entrepreneur is not for everyone's temperament, because everyone has a different level of risk tolerance. And so that's not to say that you can't join a startup or join an entrepreneurial endeavor, but maybe you're not the person that's going to start it. You're the person that's going to join early when risk is very high, but maybe a little lower. Maybe you're going to join a startup that's in growth phase where, you know, you're still, you know, knocking heads and being scrappy, but like there's not really a high probability it's going to fail in the next, you know, 2 days to 2 months.
Right.
I would also say then is entrepreneurship isn't for everyone at every stage of life. You've got, you know, young kids at home or children were just born. You're like, well, am I at a stage of life in which I can take a lot of risk? You know, so those are all things that I think people just need to evaluate early on is like, do I want to start something? Can I start something? Even before you get to an idea. So, but we'll just move past that, you know? So let's say you are in a stage of life in which you can take on some risk and you do want to start something. You know, entrepreneurs, especially young entrepreneurs, have a challenge in that they kind of see a good idea and they latch onto that idea as if it's the last idea they're going to have. And oftentimes if you are entrepreneurial, you'll see tons of opportunities everywhere. You know, I've probably had an idea for like 150 different companies, and some of those companies that I had ideas for actually became reality later on. I'm like, oh my gosh, like, you know, I've been thinking about this product for 10 years and now there's a company actually building it. How awesome. You know, I'm going to be one of the first adopters of that product. And because the truth is that a lot of other people typically, not always, but typically are having the same idea that you are around the same time. Like people.
Yeah. Is there a level of humility there that like you have to understand that, yes, this is a great idea. And because it's a great idea, probably other people have thought it.
100%. I actually tell the company all the time, like people don't invent things. We discover them. We discover inevitabilities in the world that are required for us as a species to advance with increasing levels of complexity in economics and social constructs. And when we get to the right time with the right previous inventions and the right sort of pressures, our inclination to solve problems as a species, just it, you know, we discover these solutions to things. And so it's almost like history's pre-written in a way when it comes to inventions, like somebody's bound to make it. Now, maybe you accelerate that 10 years or 20, you know, because you see a pattern well before anybody else. But like, you know, Thomas Edison is credited with inventing the light bulb. Thomas Edison made the first light bulb that worked for more than 30 minutes. There was hundreds of teams around the world inventing the light bulb around the same time. And many came to a competitive product within months of Edison's invention. So, you know, again, like we're discovering things. So there certainly is a level of humility. Like you come up with a good idea, you're not really that special. It's going to come down to if you decide to dedicate years of your life and years of other people's lives to actually seeing it come to, you know, fruition and realization. So I would say for entrepreneurs looking at ideas, like hold the idea loosely at first and then really evaluate if this is the idea that you're willing to dedicate a decade, potentially a fourth of your working professional life at actually seeing come true, because it's always harder than you think it is. If that is the case, you do find an idea and it's like, you know, the rock in your shoe, the proverbial rock in your shoe, like I can't get this rock out of my shoe. You're like, okay, well, maybe that's something you should pay attention to. Well, now you need to do a competitive analysis. Like, has anybody else made this idea? How big is the market? I have entrepreneurs not infrequently come to me and like ask me advice and they're like, hey, I've got this idea. And really, if you look at the market size, the market size is going to help dictate how large of a company you might have. And so if the whole market worldwide is, say, $100 billion, well, how much of that market can you capture? 5%? 10%?
Right.
That means the maximum revenue of your company is going to be $5 to $10 billion, which means that when you apply market multiples to the valuation, that tells you how much your company could be worth, best case scenario, if you absolutely crush it and execute perfectly. And sometimes that equation might be like, oh, shoot, my company at max could be worth $25 million. Okay, well, that's not a venture-backed company. A venture capital firm's not going to give you $3 million on speculation. You can return 25. They want huge multiples, which means that if you want to start that company, you're either going to need to raise a little seed capital from family or bootstrap it, meaning you're going to have to build it over time on your own. And so, you know, when you think about, like, I've got an idea, I want to start a company. Okay, well, based on market conditions, what type of company can it be, which is going to dictate how you start it? And so that's a lot of filtering that's actually going to eliminate a lot of ideas or endeavors that you might actually undertake. I think it's not till you actually know, I want to do this, I can do this, and I have an idea that is worth starting, and I know how to start it, meaning I know what type of company it is. Is it a nonprofit? Is it a for-profit? There's lots of things to consider. At that point, that's really where the journey begins, because you have now have only got to the point of actually contemplating and intellectualizing and strategizing and thinking about how to do the thing. There's a lot of work to do before you even get to an idea that's worthy of being pursued.
Yeah, clearly. It reminds me a lot of, you know, I guess, you know, keep throwing out the military parallels, but it's like doing the IPB, right? Like, you just don't deploy. There's a lot of work that goes into it before you even, like, start ginning up your 6-month teep for your 100%. Deployment.
Absolutely. Yeah. No question. But then, you know, after that, like, it's you get to that step. I mean, now it's strategy, it's team recruitment, it's fundraising, it's building the product, it's going to market, it's all execution, you know, it's strategy and execution at that point. But I think where entrepreneurs get in trouble is when they don't do that early work. You either end up committing to something you really didn't want to pursue for 10 years, or you find yourself 5 years into a project and go, shoot, like, I thought every startup could just be this huge company. And you're like, that's really dictated by the market, you know?
Yeah. That's so fascinating. And so, I mean, this is probably a very obvious question, but I mean, it's got to be super exciting, right? Like,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think when I'm leading people in solving complex problems together and trying to achieve something that excites the inner drive in people, I feel the most alive at work. So I, you know, presently with Pangea, I mean, I feel like I'm at my best professional self I've ever been. And I have a high tolerance of risk. I'm a fairly stress-resistant, self-assured person, so I can carry that without it, you know, impacting my family in a detrimental way. And right. So, you know, like, I feel, yeah, super excited. I, of course, there's always exceptions, but generally speaking, I'm excited to get up and go to work every day. You know, if for people that are of similar, you know, makeup at similar times in their life, I can't recommend entrepreneurship enough. It's just, you know, if you don't count the cost early, it can eat you alive, you know, so you just want to make sure you do that up front. But yeah, dude, super fun. Yeah, it's an amazing experience.
Yeah, man, this has been so great, dude. I feel like, and the thing that I'm loving about this conversation is so much of it is over my head, but I find it just so interesting. And your perspective is so valuable, because I think a lot of this does just transfer onto other things. Like, we may be talking specifically about startups, but there's a ton of lessons here that I think can apply across a myriad of life experiences. But as we are wrapping up, like, for those listeners who still, you know, who feel like, I've got this great idea, I can do the work, what would you like? Do you have any advice for them?
Yeah,
other
I would
than
say
send you their resume.
Yeah, I would say for those that feel like they're in a place to embark in an entrepreneurial endeavor, and for who have a great idea, you know, think about what your future clients or customers would Google to find you. Go Google that and see what companies are out there either solving the problem, what people are saying about it, what comes up when you Google it or ask ChatGPT, and really start to do, you know, the orientation to the battlefield, so to speak. And typically in that process, it will leave you with a lot of understanding and lessons learned. Either, hey, I've got an idea, because this is the same journey I went on with Pangea. I had a problem I wanted solved. I assumed it had been solved. So I Google to find a solution so we can implement it at a Bible project. And I was woefully disappointed with the state of the market and the solution, so much so that I'm like, this has to be solved. This is insane that there is no solution. So sometimes that will be the conclusion you come to, that like, though this really hasn't been solved, I'm not even sure anybody's thinking about it the right way. Mm-hmm. But then sometimes you'll find a competitor who's early to market and you're like, oh, what I'm thinking of is better than that. Or, oh, actually they solved some of what I was thinking about, but there's this niche or there's this segment of it that I might be able to hone in on. So it's just that orientation of the battlefield approach to really gaining intelligence on the market and your potential product. That will just, you know, leave you with so many, I think, it'll help you with your perspective and level you up in your understanding of what it is that you're embarking on. And I don't even need to share any more, you know, ideas or concepts, because I think just that one activity will get you to a place to step forward in more in a way in which you can better appreciate what it is your next steps are.
Sure. Sure. If I can offer something to dovetail on that, and you tell me
Yeah,
this is valuable or not, but it reminds me a lot, you know, as I've been doing, you know, going through my creative writing, academic career, and, you know, having to workshop different ideas and stuff, is that this idea of like, and I guess this goes back to sort of our earlier comment of having to be that like influencer or find that you know, be able to have that YouTube hot take that nobody else has. My advice, or it sort of to dovetail off of what you're saying, is also with that Googling, don't be afraid of being derivative.
Totally.
Sometimes the derived product is actually the end state. Like you said, somebody may be early to market, but whatever you could derive off of that may be the thing that everybody really truly does need. They just haven't realized it yet. You know, think about like crafting stories. Like, dude, if we were afraid of not being derivative, then all storytelling would have stopped like at the Bible, right? Like,
oh, for sure.
And so it's like, don't let that be a deterrent though. Find, like you said, find the niche, find the need, or just tell the story, but don't think that it has to always be an original idea.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's we're all ultimately standing on the shoulders of giants who came before us. I mean, without, you know, there is no MySpace without AOL. There is no Facebook without MySpace. You know, people talk about first mover advantage. Most first movers aren't, when anytime somebody talks about the first mover advantage, and I'm doing air quotes here on the screen between the two of us, that first mover probably wasn't really the first mover. The first mover either solved the problem in sort of a hacksaw way, because technology wasn't where it needed to be, or they failed entirely. And so absolutely, like, that's why I say, you know, when you do that research, it's not there to deter you. It's there to confirm and deny assumptions and to gain understanding and intelligence, you know, on what it is that on how to approach building the thing that you really feel passionately about building.
Yeah. It makes me think of the story of the origin of Transformers. One of the executives that has, what's that?
I don't know the story.
Oh, this is great. So yeah, as an 80s kid, man, like Transformers, G.I. Joe, like, dude, that was the after-school power hour. Well, the cartoon...
I woke up... I would wake up at 5:30 every day to watch Transformers Beast Wars. I don't know if you remember that one.
Where they were
animals that transform. I love that show. Yeah.
So I'm going to go way back, man, to the Robots in Disguise. So the idea of the cartoon was to talk up the toy. And the way that the toy came about was some executive at Hasbro was with his kids in Tokyo. And they went into a toy store and the kid just would not leave alone the giant fighting robot that would change into stuff.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
And so the guy was like, all right, well, we can obviously there's a market here for the toy. But there's a market here for, like, if we could just come up with a storyline, an origin story for this robot, it's going to explode into this cultural phenomenon. And so, that's where it came from. It came from a 10-year-old not letting go of a toy in Tokyo is how we got Transformers.
I love that. That's actually, origin stories for some of the big companies out there, like, have equally... humble beginnings, you know. Sometimes inspiration sparks in the most unlikely of places. That's cool.
Yeah. Well, Aaron, man, dude, this has been so cool. I'm gonna be coming out. The plan right now is I'll be coming out to the West Coast in the fall. So, dude, pencil me in, man, for some Fred's time there in Old Town.
Absolutely. Love that.
Yeah, the Mexican food here just hasn't quite matched up, man. So I gotta get out
there. Yeah, Mexican food doesn't travel well, both metaphorically.
Right.
but yeah, I'd love to see you. Thanks for having me on the show. Thanks for following up on that conversation. Hopefully for any of our budding entrepreneurs that are Marines out there, they can find something valuable from this conversation.
For sure. Is there any social media or anything that I can link folks to find you?
I don't do social media, but I am on LinkedIn.
Okay. So if you don't mind, we'll hit the LinkedIn, hit you up on LinkedIn the show description. Also put Pangea on there for folks to find you.
Yep. Pangea.io. And
all the stuff you guys are doing over there. Well, Aaron, man, always a pleasure. You're a breath of fresh air, man. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. Cheers.
A common axiom is that those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it. Another axiom is that we sweat in peace so that we don't bleed in war. Here at the Marine Corps Association, we fully understand both. That is why we offer through our professional development page on our website a comprehensive catalog of battle studies, tactical and ethical decision games, and war games to ensure that not only do we learn from the past, but we embrace the thoughts and decisions that influence the outcomes of some of the greatest actions of the Marine Corps. We have tools and techniques that will enhance both unit training as well as enable comprehensive self-study. Check out all that the Marine Corps Association has to offer on our website. Go to mca-marines.org/professional-development. That's mca-marines.org/professional-development and get your reps and sets in. Scuttlebutt is a production of the Marine Corps Association. You have heard the voices or contributions from Major Vic Rubel, USMC retired, Nancy Lichman, and or William Truding, and Aaron Sullivan. Ty Frazier is the editor, sound engineer, and technical producer. The Marine Corps Association is not an agency of the United States government. The opinions expressed in this episode are the personal views of the participants and do not reflect the official position of the United States Marine Corps, Department of Defense, or the Marine Corps Association.